Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guests, we're delighted to be joined by Kate Kennedy. And Kate has just published a paper in Nature, so congratulations on that, Kate, as joint first author, and with a big list of co-authors. And I should state that several of the authors work with me here at APC Microbiome Ireland.
Your very provocative paper in Nature addresses a very active debate. Can you tell us about the debate and what your paper's position on it was?
Yeah, absolutely. So the paper that our group recently published is looking at the debate on whether humans are colonized by microbes prior to birth and whether there is or is not a fetal microbiome. And this is, in the history of microbes and humans, a fairly recent debate that emerged in the past decade or so, where people started to look at fetal and placental tissues and amniotic fluid. And there were quite a number of studies that used 16S microbial sequencing to conclude that there were microbes or a signal of microbial DNA present in some of these tissues. And soon after those papers started being published, claiming that there was fetal colonization, those results began to be questioned as well by people who pointed out that a lot of the signals that were being found were not biologically plausible and were more likely actually contamination signals. I think and I hope that with this paper, we settled the issue a bit and it'll no longer be such a contentious topic of debate.
And Kate, you know, the old scientific truism is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. You must have heard that 1,000 times since you started considering this paper. How do you address that thing that just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's not there?
Yeah, absolutely. And this isn't the first paper that I've published on the fetal microbiome. And the first one that I was a co-author on, we were in our conclusions and in our discussion quite explicit about the fact that we weren't proving that there are no microbes there and that it is, in fact, impossible to prove that there are no microbes in a healthy fetus. But in this current paper, the prospective one, we reviewed the current evidence, but then also brought in experts from a number of different perspectives to address the biological plausibility of microbes colonizing the healthy fetus. So I think we can say, not only from the absence of evidence, but also from everything else that we know about reproductive biology and immunology and microbial ecology, that it's unlikely to the point of implausibility for there to be microbes colonizing a healthy fetus.
Well, Kate, let's talk about this because, you know, when you say just because you don't see something, that doesn't mean it's not there. In your case, you would really criticize the empiricists that thought they were seeing something, and you're bringing in additional theoretical considerations as to why what they think they're seeing isn't really there. Can you talk about what has caused other people to think that it's not sterile?
Yeah, absolutely. So there have only been a few studies that have actually looked at the fetus itself and microbes that are present. There have been others that have looked at amniotic fluid or the placenta. But in the vast majority of these cases, I think the first hurdle that many of these studies end up falling over is sampling of these tissues. And particularly for the fetal microbiome studies, almost all of them have looked at samples that have been collected following a vaginal delivery of fetal tissues. And it's very difficult to, or I would say impossible, to collect tissues sterilely if they're already being exposed to the maternal vaginal microbiota. So the main source of contamination in the majority of these studies is very likely the vaginal microbiota, and that shows up in what microbes we actually see in their results. So things like lactobacillus, which is a really common vaginal microbe, but even ignoring that, contamination happens at every stage of the process, going from the sample itself to the data that you get out of it. And if you don't have really stringent controls across all of these different potential areas of contamination, it is easy to mistake a signal that you're seeing for being a true signal and not be able to identify it as actually being a contaminant.
I know some of these scientists who drawn those conclusions, Kate, and maybe you've met them yourself. And, you know, I can't characterize all of them the same, but there are some superb scientists among them and who've done wonderful work in other areas. And I wonder sometimes, is it just the almost the ease with which we can sequence things now that draws us down that path of just analyzing whatever we can sequence? Do you think we should have been using different methods maybe than sequencing? Is sequencing perhaps just not the right method for this question?
I think that sequencing, I think you're absolutely right that a lot of these studies might not have, or even seem like they maybe weren't designed from the outset to be answering the questions that they ended up addressing. And with the explosion of microbiome research, I think a lot of people who weren't coming from microbiology perspective rightly became really interested in the impact of the microbiome. And I think sequencing definitely has a part to play here, but it's not by itself enough to answer the questions of whether a particular environment is sterile or not, because it is so sensitive to contaminants that can be present. And also because it can't address the question of whether any microbial DNA that's present is actually reflective of a true live microbe.
There also, I guess, is an issue with the mitochondrial DNA.
Yeah, we bring this up in the paper because a lot of people who have looked at these haven't just been limited to sequencing-based analyses and have tried to use other methods to support their claims, including quantitative PCR to measure bacterial DNA abundance in their samples. And they have in some cases found that there is some evidence to say that there's more bacterial DNA in the samples than in negative controls. But one of the points we bring up in the paper is that this doesn't account for a couple of things, one of which being that the tissue samples themselves have human DNA in them, which could have a carrier effect that increases the amplification of any contaminating DNA that's present in those samples. But also human cells have mitochondrial DNA, which we know is bacterial in origin, and there's some overlap in what is amplified, and it's not just going to be bacterial, but also that mitochondrial DNA. And we do see that in the 16S sequencing as well, and that's something that's removed usually from microbial studies of 16S sequencing, but it wasn't accounted for in the studies that did use qPCR to quantify bacteria.
It's one of the things that worries me a little bit, Kate. I don't know what background you are, whether you're wet lab or bioinformatician, but you know, now most groups that want to do a reasonable job at analyzing the microbiome need both bioinformaticians and wet lab scientists. But we've not yet reached a point, I think, where we completely share the same language and background and understanding. So, you know, if you were to say to me as a microbiologist, a wet lab microbiologist, there are bacteria in a fetus, and I have to prove that to you as a wet lab microbiologist, I'd be pretty comfortable in assessing whatever data you gave me. But if a bioinformatician tells me, you know, we found these sequences and we mapped them to this, and I'm on a ledge a little bit with that kind of work. Do you think that's a bit of a problem for microbiome science? We're trying to bring together disparate disciplines, which of course is wonderful, but there could be little missteps and miscommunications between the two groups, or three or four groups, or how many groups there are.
Yeah, absolutely. I myself am, I think, at the interface between wet lab and bioinformatics, jack of all trades, master of none situation. But I think you're completely right that you need both. But also for all of these microbiome studies, you need to understand not only the microorganisms and the bioinformatics, but also the host and the biological situation that you're dealing with. So I think that there are a lot of different perspectives that need to come together. And that was something that was a really fun part of this paper, I think, working with so many different experts across different arenas.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How did it come to be that a brilliant young scientist in Canada came to co-first author a paper with somebody across the pond and have so many luminaries on it?
Yeah, of course. I can't say that I know all of the details because the senior author of the paper, Jens Walter, was really the mastermind coordinating everyone to bring this paper about. But I can speak a little bit about my own experience and how I got involved. So back in 2021, I published, along with a group of co-authors, obviously, a paper looking at fetal meconium in C-section infants that we collected before, like, during the process of delivery. So it was from before the infants were actually born, which is why we were able to call it fetal meconium. And after that came out, there was a paper about a month later, Mishra et al., that came out and found the opposite of what we had found, essentially. And Jens reached out to my supervisor, Deb Sloboda, and through an email to thank her for publishing our paper first, saying that he thought it was really important. And if we hadn't published it at that time, that this other paper could have had more of a negative impact, maybe, let's say. So at that time, Deb replied to him and let him know that I had already told her I wanted to write a letter to respond to this paper that had come out after ours, and asked him if he wanted to be involved in that. And he replied and said that he was already planning this perspective paper that we just had come out. So that's how I came to be involved in it.
I was a little bit curious as to what you might think the biological implications would be for, let's suppose there are tiny, tiny amounts of microbes present in the placenta or the amniotic fluid or the fetus. You know, how important could that be? Or would it just be at those levels that they must be at to be detected at such, you know, on the edge of technology? Would they have any functional role at all, would you think?
I think that if it were true that there were small numbers of bacteria present, that would have huge implications for our understanding of biology and immunology, because that is inconsistent with pretty much everything that we know about fetal immunology and the placenta, and that would completely overhaul a number of areas of biology. So it would lead to questions like, how is the fetus limiting the growth of these microbes? Because it is a fairly nutrient-rich environment, and we know that in the case of pathogens, they are able to quickly grow in number and persist as an infection, even if the mother is capable of clearing it herself. So how the fetus would be able to distinguish between those pathogens and these commensal microbes and be able to limit their growth and be immunologically educated by them would be, if that were true, would be paradigm shifting for sure.
Yeah, I found it very compelling how you argued that in the paper that there would have to be the identification of mechanisms immunologically and anatomically that have not been identified in order to explain how the host could tolerate the microbiome.
It's easy to say that as a scientist in whatever discipline, you have to always be skeptical and interrogate these things yourself and understand all of the aspects of the work that you're doing. But I think that as the science that everyone is doing is becoming increasingly complex, and all of these big papers that come out have 20 panels per figure, it's not realistic to say that every author on every paper understands every aspect of the science that they're doing. So you do have to trust the work of other people in cases where the conclusions that you're drawing would be so paradigm shifting and disruptive. I think the bigger the implications of what you think you're showing, the more closely you need to interrogate the evidence that you're drawing those conclusions from. And it does frequently require close collaboration with experts across a number of disciplines.
Kate, I was also struck by you reanalyze some of the data. And this, I think, is one of the wonderful things about the way science has developed, that, you know, the people who publish the original data, they believe their data, they put it online. They'd make it available. I mean, sometimes journals make you do that, you know, but people are generally very willing to share data. In the full knowledge, it could be reanalyzed and maybe someone could disagree with the conclusions. Was that an important thing for you, that you could actually take their original data literally from the, I assume you took it from like the raw reads almost and took it right through the pipeline again?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a huge benefit in the papers that we were able to reanalyze the data and that it was all provided. And I think that is so important for any paper that's being published. And it's good when the journals require that, because I know if data is available upon request, that there have been studies showing that that can be difficult to actually get, especially if a paper was published a while ago, that data might be impossible to retrieve. It might no longer exist anywhere. So that was, without having that data available, it wouldn't have been possible to do the reanalysis.
Your paper has a wonderful table that talks about the potential for contamination and mitigation according to, you know, the presumed levels of biomass, that bacterial biomass that you'd expect. Can you talk a little bit about how your thoughts have evolved on that? Do you think that what you put there was common sense, or is it something that you guys had a lot of discussion about?
What is or isn't common sense is something that's ever changing, and that as time has gone on for microbiome studies in general, the standards to which we hold the methods have become increasingly rigorous. And that goes hand in hand, I think, with the methods becoming more sensitive and more powerful. So I feel like it is more common sense now, but if you are working on a study that you developed 5 years ago and you're still working on getting it published, you might not be able to go back and add negative controls for everything that you would want to have them for. So I think that in the case where that's not possible, we just need to be really transparent in what we're able to say or not say from the data that we do have.
It seems poor preparation, if you leave me put it this way, for the mother to let the baby reach full gestational age and then deliver it into a microbially crammed world. And, you know, we can see that, for example, in mother's milk, and particularly the first feedings, you know, there's all these prebiotics and things aimed at supporting a microbiome, the baby, and not have prepared the baby in some way for this coming storm of microbes it's going to encounter. Now, assuming the microbes aren't actually in there, how do you think the mother might be preparing the baby for this soon to come encounter with microbes?
If we're correct and there are no microbes before birth, that is a huge transition to go through, to be born and suddenly be colonized with all of these microbes from the mother and from the environment. And my co-authors and I think, are in agreement in that, or I know we are all in agreement that our conclusions that the fetus does not have live microbes doesn't mean that the maternal microbes are unimportant to development. And we, in the paper, address a couple ways in which the maternal microbiota and the maternal immune system can potentially be educating the fetus, even in the absence of fetal colonization. So things like microbial metabolites, like short-chain fatty acids, we know those can cross the placenta and reach the fetus. And we know maternal immunoglobulins can cross the placenta, and those might carry microbial antigens. So there definitely, or there have been, one of the studies we cite shows that microbial components can reach the fetus, but it's unlikely that microbial or microbes themselves, as whole live microbes, are actually reaching the fetus. So that doesn't mean that the fetus is entering the world after and during birth completely naive to all microbes. And another consideration there is looking at preterm birth and the increased incidence of infections in babies who are born too early. That indicates that especially later on in pregnancy, there's likely some continued immune education that's important for colonization and pathogen resistance after birth.
Can we finish, Kate, on a kind of personal note? You know, getting a first name paper in Nature is can be almost career making. It's a fantastic achievement and congratulations once again. But you got it for, you know, something where you're sticking your head above the parapet a little bit. You're a young scientist. Had you any trepidation at all about maybe being the head name on this paper that was trying to take down a growing area of science almost?
I had no trepidation about being named as first author on a Nature paper as a postdoc. I didn't think for a minute to say no, I don't want to be involved in this. And in large part because I think that the science that we're presenting is solid, and I think that we are on the right side of science history with this. But I also, on a more personal note, one of my favorite things in science is when people are passionately arguing about something. And I feel like a lot of the time, that's where we are able to make these advances. So I really enjoy having a genuine debate about whatever aspect of science, including the fetal microbiome. And so, I don't know, I was very excited to be included on this paper.
Well, we're excited to have brilliant and brave young scientists like you come into the field and help us see the errors of our ways. So this was a beautiful paper, Kate. I want to congratulate you and also on the very great career that you've already started.
Well, thank you very much. So that's kind of you to say.
Thanks, Kate.